It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 343 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is another great doubleheader episode as I talk with the folks from Crowded, a new Image comic that just came out this week. I talk to writer Christopher Sabella, then the art team of Rose Stein and Ted Brandt. You can check out the review by Robert Mamone on majorspoilers.com. Then everything wraps up with Bob Sally, the creator of Ogre. Number one is available to order through your local shop, so be sure to get to them right away. Bob will give you that information. He's also the creator of Salvagers, which he updates. You can also check out my advance review of Ogre number one at majorspoilers.com. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Things are getting kind of crowded here at the podcast, and that's because we're talking about the book Crowded from Image Comics. Chris Sabella, you've been here on the podcast before. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. It's good to talk with you. And two new people, Ro Stein, who's the artist. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay, Ro and Ted Brandt, inker, right, Ted?
Yes. Hello.
Okay, so we're good. We got everybody together here. Chris, why don't we start talking a little bit about, we'll start with you and talk about the fact that, you know, this is, the word it's crowded and always makes me think of the word, the crowdfunding kind of stuff. There's a lot of apps and things going on in this book. Do you want to talk a little bit about where the story idea came from?
Sure. As far as where it came from, I'm not really sure. It's just one of those things that popped into my head one afternoon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea of people crowdfunding to assassinate somebody just sounded like something I kind of wanted to chase down and figure out how that would work and what kind of world that would be. So from there, really, it was mostly figuring out the actual story, which is, you know, our story is about a woman, Charlie Ellison, who wakes up one morning and she has one of these assassination campaigns open on her, and like 2,000 plus people have already backed it. It's already over $1 million, and she has no idea why. So she hires a bodyguard from a protection app that's sort of like Uber, and her bodyguard Vita basically has to keep her alive for the next 30 days as everybody in Los Angeles is trying to kill her and collect the money that her campaign has raised.
Mm-hmm. I could see that happening, especially with all the different apps. You know, we talked about Uber and the Airbnb and stuff, which have changed my life as far as like traveling goes. I don't mm-hmm. I never take a taxi anymore. I'm always on Uber, and then I don't stay in the hotels unless I absolutely have to. And I'll stay Airbnb. So you're touching on something that's very current, which is good, because oftentimes comic books are kind of behind on these kinds of things. It's nice to see this book actually be up to date with technology that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I understand a little bit why, you know, because you sort of run the risk of dating yourself, but I'm kind of okay with that. Like, you know, the story that we're telling, I think, is pretty timeless. Like, the circumstances are definitely, I mean, are definitely more related to the era we're living through now, but that was just sort of a happy or, you know, just a random accident. But yeah, I was just, the more I dived into it, the more all this stuff kind of felt like it belonged together. I'm certainly not trying to write a book that's like, you know, here's my thoughts and feelings about life in, you know, these times. It's just more of a, like, boy, these times are really screwed up. They make for a good backdrop to an action book.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you shredded out all the technology, you could still have a really interesting story going on.
I think so, yeah.
So that's good. So, okay, let's talk to Ro. Now, you and Ted worked together on comics. I see you worked on Captain Marvel, Raven the Pirate Princess, and things like that. Do you guys always work together? How do you guys do that?
Well, so far we've always worked together. Mm-hmm. When we get the script, we break it down together and figure out how it's going to work on the page. And Ted's very good at splitting up the real estate of the page so that everything's got the right amount of space and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I will go figure out what the shots are for those actions and pencil it in. Mm-hmm. And then Ted makes it look all nice.
So you guys do this on paper or is this on the computer?
Bit of both, because I work digitally, and then we print it off onto paper for Ted to ink traditionally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Ted, as far as like, it sounds like you're doing more than just inking. It sounds like you're helping with the layout of the page and stuff like that. So, you guys really are collaborators in the pure sense of the word.
Oh, yeah. Like, we're absolutely a team. We're not easily split apart into exactly, you know, pure job roles at all. Because I also contributed design stuff to the look of Vita was my design.
Okay.
Or Ro actually putting it together. Mm-hmm. But so yeah, it's definitely much more of a partnership type deal.
Okay, sounds good. So it's kind of interesting to me because the layout varies from page to page. And I like the look of the characters, too. So you guys are doing a really good job on this one, I think.
Thank you.
I got to get back to design because I noticed in the credits that, Chris, you're listed as script/design, and yet some of the characters seem to be designed by Ted and others. How does that work?
I mean, my design, book design.
Oh.
So, like, I did, like, you know, the interior front covers and the interior back cover and, like, the back cover. It's all graphic design. Like, really, I have nothing to do with how the actual pages look other than the scripts that I write. And, like, you know, in a very rare instance, I will suggest, like, hey, this should look exactly like this. But more often than not, I'm just like, here's what happens, not in a dismissive way, but like, you figure out how it looks because you're much better at that. So,
okay, very good. Now, I got to ask you, Ro, because one of the great things about the book is that we get to see the main character, Charlie, in various situations. You know, she's doing like 10, 12 jobs a day. It seems like she's walking dogs. She's Uber driving people. She actually sits on a bench with a guy that's lost his wife so they can feed the pigeons together and stuff. That must have been fun to kind of everyday life stuff and make it interesting visually.
Well, yeah, because where we excel at really is human interaction and portrayal of humanity, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's what's the most interesting, probably, trying to find the character that's been described and what their inner life is and portray it out on the page visually.
I gotta ask about the older woman. There's an older woman walking a dog. And I love the look of the older woman. I was just kind of intrigued. I mean, did you do that, Ted? Was that your thing?
Oh, no, that was definitely Ro's design.
Ro's design, okay. Did you base that on anybody, Ro?
I don't think so, but I think she was based more on, like, if a pug was a person.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, we've got a special fondness for her, and if time permits, across the course of the book, we've actually...
We want to see her again.
Yeah, oh, we not only do on Syrian, but we've actually said to Chris, because we've talked about the idea of maybe having... other writer and artist teams do like one shots to kind of flesh out the world. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, we've said to Chris that we'd like one focusing on that woman.
Now she's walking the dog. I have to talk about the dog a little bit because that dog likes everybody, seems like. Even though the dog barks at some people, during the whole book, that dog goes from person to person to person as they go along. And so I'm just fascinated by it. Is that a Chihuahua? Is that what that's based on?
Yeah, it was the initial design was looking specifically at teacup chihuahuas because they are basically like 90% head. So, and I, well, when you're that small, you really don't have a choice of who you go with. It's not a lot you can do. You can fit in a pocket.
Now, see, Ro, I have to talk with you because one of the things I loved about the book was your expressions, the ability to show different facial expressions. And the dog even has expressions that are kind of fun to watch and look at. And I just thought that was so cute about, you know, being able to do not only human expressions but canine expressions. That's quite a nice thing. So I want to tell you guys, I really enjoyed that. That was one of the aspects of the books I really liked.
Oh, good. I'm glad about that.
Because there's motion going on and things happening. And I'll talk to you, Chris, because I'm fascinated by the fact that things aren't exactly as they seem when the book starts out. And the mystery starts to unfold as we go along. And how many issues are in this book? And are you going to have? Is this a mini series? How's this going to work?
No, we're somewhere north of 20.
Okay.
You know, we're still, I use the same analogy every time, but basically it's like we know where we're going. We know what the ending is. It's just a matter of, like, if we want to take a really direct route or the more scenic route.
Okay. Because it calls it version 1.1. Is it always going to be 1.something, or at some point we're going to get to version 2? How's that going to work?
I figured I would change it by arcs.
Okay.
So then, yeah, that's just me being cutesy.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just, like, trying to look for some more like unifying way to name the issue with all our technology stuff. So it might be a little too twee. If I had to go back and change something, I might change that. But now we're locked in.
Once it comes out, it's there. Now, I have to ask you, I don't know if you did this, Chris, or maybe Ted or somebody did, but there's a little icon in the word crowded. The O is actually like a red icon with a white skull symbol on it, and it's very pixelated, which of course is the way these icons go. Actually, that's the way the book ends. You show the little icon again, which I always like that. I'm big on icons and how they work and how people use them. Did you come up with that design?
No, that was our my friend Dylan Todd, who's a designer, and he's done logos he did the logo for Shanghai Red, and Heartthrob and Cold War. He's kind of my go-to guy to get logos from. And that was like one of the three that he sent us. And I think we all like pretty much loved it right away.
Because like I said, it's interesting that we see that little icon again down the road. So I like that. That was a great use of, you know, I like it when things repeat and they have meaning to it. So when we get to the end of the book, we know it's the end of the book because we see the icon.
Yeah, like it's a nice little, you know, like certainly... it was another like happy accident, like, you know, cause I just asked Dylan for a logo and we got lucky enough that he gave us one that had this like sort of perfect icon right in the middle of it. So it's a nice visual shorthand for our book. And it's a nice way to like, yeah, use as like a, like you have now reached the end of this issue and you'll definitely see it popping up more like, especially, issue 2 and onwards, you know, it shows up in the pages itself as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I got to talk, Ro, with you and Ted about the cover. The cover is another very modern thing going on. While all these people are trying to kill her and she's got the Vita in front of her, what is Charlie doing? But she's taking a selfie, which I love that about the cover. Was that your concept? Did you guys come up with that?
Yeah, I mean, like...
It was a long time ago now.
Yeah, like most of the covers, we've had a few ideas about, like, but that one we really struggled with for a long time, actually. Yeah, when we were making the pitch, it took us a long time to get, and we just wanted something that would accurately sum up who Charlie and Vita are. So you've got Charlie continuing to live her life as best she can, whilst Vita is there.
Acting as the wall.
Exactly. Walling her off from all the danger. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, you know, hands down, Trina Farrell, our colorist, did an incredible job. Like, we didn't give her any direction on the cover, but that beautiful kind of slightly pixelated effect on the background really nailed it.
It's really good. And of course, we get to see the older lady on the cover, too. She's on the bottom right. So every time I get to see her, I pay attention. I get a huge kick out of that. Really good stuff. Now, I do have to ask about their appearances. I mean, Charlie being a young woman, and obviously in Los Angeles, and then Vida being a person, a woman of color, I love strong female characters. And so to me, when I saw that these two were the ones that the story's going to be about, I was really pleased because I never see enough of this. I haven't gotten tired of seeing this kind of character interaction. So as far as their appearance goes, you know, talk about, again, I always like to think, are they based on somebody? But it may just be your imagination. Who is Charlie based on somebody? Is Vida, is she somebody that we would know? How did you guys come up with the design for these characters?
I think Vita was inspired by a photo you saw of Ruby Rose, wasn't it?
Yeah, she was. There was a particular photo of Ruby Rose, the actress, who's just been cast as Batwoman.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wearing a suit and had a similar kind of haircut to that. So while we knew we wanted Vita to be a woman of colour, there was a lot of the attitude that made it over into Vita's design. But really, as far as Vita goes, then I wanted someone who was quite androgynous, just because we don't get a lot of androgynous characters in comics generally. And, you know, I wanted her to be, she's tall, she's imposing, but she's not hugely rippling with muscle.
Mm-hmm.
She's, you know, so I wanted her to be more in that kind of John McClane style toughness, the original one, not the beefier version you get as the series goes on,
right?
Rather than the Rock,
right?
So I wanted her to be more the sort of person who, if she wins a fight, then you're not going to, well, if she goes into a fight, you're not going to be looking at her and saying, "Oh, she's huge. She's obviously going to have this." Mm-hmm. You know, I want the fights to feel like they have stakes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chris, I was looking at the, there's an interesting, there's a description of the book that Image just put out, and there's a part of it that gets me, that I was, because while we're talking about Vita, I thought we might go into that, is that Vita is the lowest rated bodyguard on the app that Charlie uses. I'm kind of fascinated, because is it because of cost that she chose Vita? Well, why did she choose Vita if she's the lowest rated one?
Vita was the only one who responded.
Oh, explains it.
So, yeah, like everybody else just, you know, saw that pop up and was like, oh, yeah, no thanks. Like, you know, you're just a regular person and you have, you know, $1.4 million on your head. Like, yeah, that's not worth my time. But Vita is just struggling and trying to make a living. So what choice, you know, does she have except to say yes? So.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when you understand that, you understand a lot more about the character. For example, they meet at what looks like a low-level McDonald's. It's called Auto Mac, which I thought was a funny name for that. And you, by the way, during the book, you got to name all these different apps and stuff going on. That must have been fun. I'm waiting for some people to start actually using these names to set up apps as well.
Yeah, we should trademark this stuff. Right, yeah.
Well, especially as the book goes on, we've got a load of TV shows and like store brand names and things like that. Yeah, we definitely need to start registering some of those, because they're going to happen eventually.
I can see them coming. I mean, people are desperate for these kinds of things, and I'll bet you anything, somebody's out there, when they get a hold of this book, you're going to start seeing that fly around, so... That's kind of fun. Of course, that tells you how good it is, that how close it is to what we could see, how realistic it is. I like that a lot. Now, I want to talk about Vita's home, because I think that's what, and her car. You know, how you explained her and talked about her as being like somebody just making a living makes sense, because Charlie actually ridicules her for the car that she's driving as well as the house that she lives in. You know, that's not somebody I would do, somebody trying to keep me alive. So I was kind of, it showed a little bit about both characters and how they interacted on that level.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, it's like Ted was saying, like, you know, that, you know, Charlie is still just trying to live her life. And Vita is the one who sort of has to shovel all the crap to keep, you know, keep Charlie living her life. There's just this sort of sense of obliviousness at first, mm-hmm. Which I think, like, a lot of people would have in this case of, like, it's normal. Everything around you is as it always was, but now, you know, suddenly anybody could just pop out of a car or something and try to kill you. and you have no idea why. And so, yeah, a lot of the first issue is still Charlie, like, in this state of being just like, oh, no, this is fine. Like, it's not as bad as it seems. And Vita is just tolerating it. But yeah, I mean, with Vita's car and her house, like, I like stuff where you can sort of, stuff like that is sort of shorthand for, to give you insight into a character, so you don't have to, like, sit down and explain this stuff. Like, you see just, like, the things that people own, or, like, you know, the stuff that's on their walls, and that, like, tells a story about them. So I've thought, like, that really fit in well with Vita.
Mm-hmm. Now, I got to ask Ro on Ted, though, is it visually, just as much as Chris was describing the personality differences between the two, visually we get to see that because she's shorter than Vita is, and Vita is always sort of, you talked about stoic and stuff, and she's much more vibrant, and oh my gosh, this is this, and then she's laughing all the time. Even though she's in danger, she's laughing. But you visually make use of that in the sense that the way that she stands real tall, and she kind of looks back at Charlie, rather than look at her in the face very often. So from the artwork, you get a sense of the differences between the characters as well. Well, I like that bit about the characters, that even visually you were able to communicate the differences of the characters. So I like that a lot. So as far as like action sequences and things go, there's one sequence, I don't want to spoil stuff out of the thing, but let's just say there's something that every restaurant owner does not ever want to see happens in it. And it's great fun the way that you portray that and the way that that things happen. And, of course, Vita's reaction to it is great. This happens occasionally. Did you use any visual references, or was this something that you just imagined that whole sequence? How did you draw that?
Well, I make sets in SketchUp to help me figure out the exact shots we're going to use. So it's kind of a combination of remembering things that I've seen on TV and then trying to find the best way to put it onto a page thing. So I'd sort of like using direction with the sets and turning it into the panels.
But it really works really well. It's really strong. It moves the story along really nicely. I mean, Chris has a very nicely paced script, and your artwork really reflects that. I thought that was well done.
Thank you.
I've got to go back to the dog, because I love the little dog. Every time the little dog shows up, I go, aw.
He's a lot of fun.
He's a great little dog. And, of course, I don't want to spoil. There's one part where Vita is basically saying she doesn't ever want to get attached to clients. And we come to see that that may not always be true at one point, and has to do with the little dog. And I loved all that stuff. That it just makes you, you know, and the great big eyes.
you'll be seeing a lot more of dog as the book goes on.
Does the dog get anywhere? Does the dog get a name, or is it just dog?
That remains to be seen.
Okay, so we don't want to spoil much going on.
No dog spoilers.
No. There's a funny. I've seen cups of I don't care who dies in the movie as long as the dog survives.
No, yeah, you don't have to worry about that.
Okay, because I love that kind of stuff. I think that's fun to use. Now, Chris, I want to ask you, because when things start out, as I was mentioning, that things aren't always as they seem, and, you know, we've talked a little bit about the characters and stuff, but when we get to the end of the book, and I'm not going to spoil it, but let's just say we find out that one of the characters isn't necessarily as she has been portrayed in the past. I was really stunned when we get to the end of the book. Of course, that makes me want to read the next issue when we find out that there's different things going on with the characters. Talk about that and her and you know, what kind of things, you know, when you set something up, you want to sometimes break the mold so that we're interested to see what's going to happen next. Is that what you had in mind as we get to the end of the book? And I don't want to spoil stuff, but did you have that in mind as far as like shaking up something when you get there?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, yeah, I mean, I just thought it was interesting. You know, you spend the whole issue sort of getting to learn about these two people, and then sort of at the very end, you know, that one of them makes a turn that you didn't see coming and, like, sort of takes you aback. Mm-hmm. You know, but it also, like, I don't know. Yeah, it's just like, you know, it's tricky the way you decide to parcel out information. Like, I just wanted to give enough, you know, I wanted people to know and like Charlie and Vita in this first issue. Mm-hmm. Like, that was my main concern. But to also, like, sort of give them some glimpses that, you know, things are a little more complicated than they seem, you know, mm-hmm. on first meeting. It's the same as, you know, meeting anybody. It's like, you know, the first time you, like, hang out with somebody mm-hmm. is just, like, all surface-level stuff. And then the deeper you go, things get way more complex and there's a lot more emotions and motivations involved. So that's kind of how I'm approaching it, is like trying to make it feel natural the way everything comes out between these two characters, who are both of whom are definitely withholding a lot from each other.
Well, I also hate to tell you, but when you deal with people on the internet, the way they portray themselves on the internet isn't necessarily who they really are. Which is another thing that you're portraying here. You're showing that just because these people met on the internet doesn't mean that they know each other at any level at this point. So I thought was a great point, too, because you're dealing with a lot of internet and social media stuff. To have that kind of come to the end and get to the end and sort of have the story go that way, I thought, how appropriate for today that is. I think that's great.
Thanks.
So as far as – you said this is an ongoing book now?
Uh-huh.
Wow. But she's only got 30 days. I mean,
right.
I don't want it to end anytime soon, but as far as the, I mean, you know, each issue is not a day, obviously, but, you know, you've got at least 30 issues that you can do with that. You know, have you thought about what you're going to do when you get to the end of the 30 days?
We're done with the book.
Okay.
basically, like, this is the story we're here to tell. So, you know, like, we definitely have some monkey wrenches in mind and some stuff that, you know, hopefully people don't see coming. But, yeah, like, I'm, you know, I was actually doing, like, timeline math in my notebook last night, sort of figuring out, like, okay, how far along into the campaign are we and how much time do we have left? Like, so, yeah, things are just going to get, like, they go pretty frantically. Like, not a lot of stuff happens off panel or off the page. Like, you see a lot of it because it just keeps going and going. And so, yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like, yeah, there's definitely other stories, I think, mm-hmm. that can be told in this world, like Ted was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think we'd be interested in exploring that if people were into it. Mm-hmm. But I think we're all just here to tell the story of Charlie and Vita.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about the first page in particular, because that is a very eventful first page. You know, it starts out with let's just say that they meet. But by the end of the issue, somebody's dead. I was very surprised. I mean, oh, that's in one page. Normally stuff like that in comics, that takes like 5 or 6 pages before something develops like that. So you guys covered a lot of ground, and I think that sets the pace for the rest of the issue. I think you guys do a lot of things. A lot of things happen. You know, everybody talks about where they are, and, you know, we get to see a lot of Charlie's life, at least from her perspective, you know, as she's communicating it. But, man, that first page just blew me away because it was, you know, you covered so much ground in that. That was a great way to start.
Thank you. I mean, we're, like, one of the things we talked about very early on in the book is that we wanted this to be a revolt against the idea of decompression in storytelling. Mm-hmm. Older books were super compressed. And, I mean, while Ultimate Spider-Man was a hell of an achievement and a great book mm-hmm. from the word go, mm-hmm. then there's no denying the fact that they took 6 issues mm-hmm. to tell the story that was told in Amazing Fantasy 15. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going back quite that much, but we're mm-hmm. definitely trying to make sure that each issue feels like, you know, there's a good amount of story in it. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to, I mean, like Chris has said, at the end of the 30-day campaign, the book ends. We've got a lot of ground to cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why most pages have 5 or more panels on.
Mm-hmm. I think 5 is the least we've had at this point.
Wow.
I think we've had a splash page.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you bring us a couple of things to mind. I always talk about there was a series of the strips that were in the newspapers, and they put them out, the Batman ones, in collected editions. And one of the things I noticed about each strip, something happened in those like three or four panels, something significant took place. And so I'm always interested in that. The opposite of that, and this is just me, you guys don't have to agree or disagree or whatever you want. We just got Fantastic Four number one came out. They're not back together as the end of the first issue of the Fantastic Four, which bothered me a little bit. I'd like to see the Fantastic Four in the Fantastic Four book. Now, you guys don't have to comment because, you know, you might want to do stuff for Marvel someday and they might get mad, but
I haven't read it. I mean, I don't disagree with you, but, you know, I feel like something like that is like, it's such a big event that they're not going to give away everything in that first issue. I think it's also like a product of just the marketplace and how many books there are, is that, like, you know, I think definitely one of the elements to me starting the story this way is like, I want to make sure that like the reader is hooked in right away. Mm-hmm. Like, cause you know, people have so many books to choose from these days. Mm-hmm. Sometimes all you get is a first page to hook them in. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that like that first page and that whole first issue was like significant and, you know, gave you enough that made you want to come back, or at least even just made you want to like lay down money to take it home and read it.
Mm-hmm. Now I have to say, of course, if you want a book where something happens, buy Crowded. If you want a book where we sort of waffle around and try to sort of set up for the return of the main characters, then buy Fantastic Four, in my opinion. That's just me. But your book, I honestly thought more happened on your first page than happened in the whole issue of FF. So, you know, I like your kind of writing. I like your kind of artwork where things really take place. I find that so enjoyable.
Ah, sorry, there's a giant spider on my desk. This is horrible, but thank you.
Yeah,
I have to kill this.
Oh, okay. There's an action sequence for you right there on the podcast.
Yeah, no, that was terrible. Literally, he just like walked over my wrist and onto my keyboard. Mm.
You could have been the spectacular spider writer.
Man, like, this is the worst. I hate summer. Oh, he's back.
He's back. I thought he was dead.
Hold on. No. I sprayed compressed air.
Oh.
I trapped him under a can. All right, we're safe.
Okay, we're safe for now. We won't say what
happens. I don't know what I'm going to do now because he's just under there. But
we won't say what happens after the podcast ends. But
yeah.
Let's just say we'll be there. So, okay, so we've got the first issue. When this is the 15th is the release. So as of the release of this podcast, that first issue is available now. And so it'll be monthly, usually about the middle of the month. Yeah. Is that how it's going to work? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So that'll be good. So something to look forward to. Chris, I know you got a lot of projects you worked on. Any other things that you have going on, and we'll get to the other folks in a second here, that we should know about besides Crowded?
I have Shanghai Red. Which is my other Image book that's currently coming out.
Okay.
So the first two issues are out. That's a 5-issue series. Mm. And then I have a new creator-owned book coming out from IDW Black Crown called House Amok. That's it's a 5-issue horror book about a family on a summer vacation that goes insane together. Mm. So lots of fun. But really, like, yeah, Crowded is, you know, Ted and Ro and I spent like an hour last night discussing stuff to do in the second arc. So it's the thing I'm most excited about and kind of, eagerly always wanting to work on. So
you always do good stories and always have fascinating characters. So I always am looking forward to your stuff. So it's good stuff. Now, how about you, Ro and Ted? Because you guys tend to work together. Other projects that you guys are working on that we should know about?
We have all of our time dedicated to Crowded at the moment, so we don't have anything else new coming out, but we've just got our comps for the Champions Volume 3, which has our Monsters Unleashed issue printed in there too.
Cool.
Yeah. So, but yeah, as far as like new work goes, we're having some vague conversations about what to do after Crowded, but you know, that's still 2 years away. Mm-hmm. So
well, hopefully.
Okay, well, you know, I wish you guys a lot of success with it. This is a fun book. It couldn't be more timely than what it is. And so it's Crowded, and the first issue is now released, so be sure to get to your store. And if they don't have them, tell them they need to back order it and get the future issues for you. Put it on your subscription. So, you know, Chris, it's good to talk with you again.
Yeah, good to talk with you.
And Ro and Ted, it's nice to talk with you for the first time. Hopefully we get a chance to chat again in the future.
I hope so. This is fun.
And you guys have a great time and enjoy this book, because I'm having a fun reading it. So keep it up.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good luck to the spider.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's always great to talk with Bob Sally, the creator of so many good things, including the newest book, Ogre. How are you doing today, Bob?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on, Wayne. I always love being on your show.
I got to write a review of Ogre number one. You made it available to me, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm not going to spoil anything, but I got to read number two, which is even a little more interesting. I was just fascinated by some stuff that we can't talk about, of course, but it's just a fascinating comic. Talk about what Ogre is about and what might attract people to it.
I mean, I guess, like, you know, if you want to like get real deep into it, Ogre is a story for, I think, everybody, you know, like where it's, you know, the doing the things you don't want to do, having to really kind of like step up and, you know, find that mustard to come out of your shell and, you know, take initiative in anything you believe in, or even things that you don't, you know, you're not sure you believe in, but it's just that, you know, that kind of thing that propels you into doing something. And then when you're in the midst of it, you realize, like, I'm here for a purpose. So it was a story, actually, when I started outlining it, and it was this big fantasy story. And I met Sean Daly at a Comic-Con, and he and I wanted to work together. And I just kept thinking, like, well, I don't have no idea what I'm going to – I love this style, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to work with him on. And then when I talked to Travis McIntyre, the editor-in-chief of Sword Point Press, you know, he was kind of looking at this fantasy story I had, and he was like, well, what if we flip it on its head, and instead of making it, you know, this big, grand, epic fantasy story, why don't we make it a little smaller, but – in doing so, make the characters a lot more come to life more, and make them more compelling to the reader, because you can focus, you know, you can really narrow, you know, that character development on certain characters.
Give the basics. If you describe the book to somebody, what's the, like, the catch line that you use to tell people? I mean, what's the basic storyline?
So my good friend David Hayes, who I think all us creators at Source Point Press look to kind of get that log line. I'm not sure if this is the one we're going to go with, but I really liked it. He said it's Shrek meets Seven Samurai. So, and I mean, obviously, like, I have kids, so I really enjoy Shrek, and obviously Shrek is an ogre as well. And I mean, I always loved, you know, that Seven Samurai, the, you know, the Magnificent Seven, you know, the Dirty Dozen, even Suicide Squad. So I kind of like that. We still might tweak it, but it's basically a reclusive ogre goes on, you know, is egged on to go on a journey that he really is reluctant to go on by the ghost of the dead man that he's chained to.
See, that is a fascinating thing to me. I have to say that was one of the things that stood out to me when I started to read the book, and it's mentioned, it's in the publicity stuff and everything too. You know, he's chained to a dead person. But the interesting thing about, and I don't know if I don't want to spoil anything on.
We could definitely talk about that.
But there's a ghost of that person, as you said, that's talking to the ogre and gives him information. And the funniest parts about it is when he says something responding to the ghost, and people don't know that's the case, and they think he's talking to them, and they try to respond to him. He says, no, no, not that. It's not you. I always get a kick out of that. Because, you know, ogres, when I read ogres in literature and stuff, they're usually big, kind of stupid, you know, able to beat up people at with one arm kind of stuff. But this ogre is kind of different. And in fact, I something great in the second issue that comes out that gives me a question, but something interesting about the ogre is revealed in the second book. I want people to get the first book so they can get the second one and get to that place. But this ogre is a very different character than I'm used to. Was that intentional? I mean, did you approach the ogre by saying, I don't want this to be like every other ogre I've ever read?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of saying, like, you know, the way we look at, you know, the people look at things in a certain way, and they have their interpretations of things. But if we look a little bit, you know, past that, if we look a little deeper, you know, past the flesh, that, you know, maybe there's more to everybody. And you know, so I mean, I don't want to say that I was like trying to get like real philosophical with the story or anything, but I mean, I definitely had this ogre character, and I wanted to give him, you know, I wanted people to sympathize with him, and I wanted people to kind of look at him like, to maybe look at other people like that too, like, you know, to kind of see people for more than who they are on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's obviously more to the ogre than people can see, because of the ghost. And of course, what's funny is there are also lines about it too, about the condition of the body, that it's not necessarily in a condition that is makes it conducive to be around people with, which I really like.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. The ghost is kind of watching his body decay, and he's concerned about it, you know. And I think, like, for me, like, I just always thought, like, if you were a ghost, like if you were a spirit and you saw your body, you know, if you're a new spirit, you're still attached to that physical world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like that body's something, like, for years and years, that's what you've known, and you've tried to repair it. You've tried to take care of it. Mm-hmm. So now when you're a spirit and you're out of it, how do you react to it? Like, do you just, you know, I feel like most people wouldn't be like, well, to hell with it. Like, I'm not a part of it anymore. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, a spirit that was stuck here would still kind of feel like some kind of ownership to that body and want to take care of it. Mm-hmm. So that's something you kind of see throughout the story, is the way that this ghost kind of, you know, looks at his body and his decaying body, and how he plays on that.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, that, you know, the he can provide information to the ogre that is helpful to him in what's going on. Now, let's talk a little bit about the situation. I mean, right now they're in the middle of a war. And it's one of those things, you know, we look at war sort of sterile these days. You know, we've got machine guns, we've got all kinds of stuff. But they have a much different style than we're used to. Of course, this is back in the past when they're using knives and arrows and things like that, which is much more up close and personal. So talk about what the war is like and how they end up at the beginning of the book, because they're at a place where they get to the several humans as well as the ogre are there. Talk about that.
So, yeah, well, I feel like, you know, the war is kind of this backdrop to the story. It's that conflict in that kind of separates people no matter what time period it is. You know, if you talk about the Vietnam War, you have people that, you know, we're, you know, vastly against it. And then you have people that, you know, we're, you know, on, you know, all USA and, you know, whatever we're doing is the right thing to do. So the fact that, you know, I had this ogre and I had these people and they were going to be together, and there needed to be something that, you know, glued them together despite their differences. And I thought, you know, having a war going on is a perfect backdrop for any story. If it's not the main, you know, it's not the main subject of it, but it forces people to show what their views are on the world. It's, you know, if there's not a war going on, you know, people can walk around and, you know, they don't really have to have an opinion on anything. But if there's times of struggle, that's when people, no matter whether you're left or right, you know, you're going to voice your opinion somewhere. Mm-hmm. So the war between the North and the South in the story really kind of brought forth that, you know, if you want to say that sense in America where, you know, you have people like people are divided mm-hmm. on their opinions of, you know, what's right or wrong. And then within that, you go to even a more microscopic level of now you have these people that want to survive and there's an ogre in there. And it's their differences of, okay, I want to survive, but I don't like this ogre, but we need him, you know. So it kind of created a more vast backdrop of the separation of humanity than to come down to, you know, this group of people and have a more finite look at, you know, at it up close.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's some dialogue that goes on towards the beginning of the book where they discuss war. And I really liked that because I thought there was several points of view being brought forward. And I liked the way that there was because these days it's hard to have civilized discussions about things, it seems like to me. So to be able to read that discussion about war and how people looked at it and, you know, whether it was necessary or not at times, I really enjoyed that. I thought that was, for me, that was one of the highlights of the scripting of it. I thought that was a great way.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm, you know, in my writing, I've never been big into like captions to kind of set the, you know, set the scene. So I realized I'm like, okay, I have to set the scene. I, you know, immediately I was just like, okay, like I want to have this one guy who's very skeptical, who's, you know, a cynicist. So it was kind of like his, you know, his narrative on a grand scale. When you read the book, you'll see like it's kind of like, you know, you got a, you know, a 1,000 view look of the world and this guy's talking, and then as he's talking in each page, like it gets closer and closer into the cell where this man is talking. Mm-hmm. And as he's talking to the people, as you know, people who are like skeptics usually do, is you know, they want to kind of stand on their soapbox and preach about the way they think the world is, and I felt like that kind of set the tone for who this character is. Mm-hmm. And I knew that this character was going to be throughout the story. Mm-hmm. And I wanted him to, you know, I wanted to set a tone for him mm-hmm. as, you know, being this guy who is very much against the way the world is and very much against this ogre that is in the room with him, in this cell with him. So it was a way for me to kind of go from a broad, you know, broad view into this world of this small crew.
See, it's interesting because you actually touched on racism without actually having to use the word, which I liked. And I you know, bringing on, you've got various different people. Well, at the beginning of the book, they're in a cell. You know, there's obviously going to be prisoners of war, and they've got them in a cell. And that's where this discussion is happening. And it's fascinating because the ogre's there, and of course, they don't necessarily want the ogre there. But the reaction and the treatment of the ogre, I thought, was really kind of, you know, you were on some levels dealing with racism, you know, because we look at other people who are different from us and we assume certain things right away. And that's what some of the characters do about the ogre at the beginning.
And that was intentional. It was definitely intentional because I, looking at the fantasy world, it's one of the questions that I was asked for in the interview that it was, how is it different going from sci-fi to fantasy? Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt like, well, you know, I think like if you're a sci-fi writer, it's easy to transition into fantasy, much more easy than it would be to going into some kind of like detective noir, where you have, you know, a lot of rules you have to follow. So I think, you know, writers who are sci-fi writers are writers who, you know, really just don't want to follow rules.
Right.
And then to go, you know, go into fantasy, it's like, you know, you have to follow some rules, but not as many. Mm-hmm. So, you know, before I wrote this, I watched, you know, the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy. Mm. I watched Willow. Mm-hmm. I rented Willow again, like to watch that. Because mm-hmm. I knew, I'm like, well, there's certain rules. Like if you're going to write a fantasy story, you know, you have that fan base that are very particular about their rules. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like where, you know, they're going to call you out on the things that you might stray away from. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was definitely something where I realized I'm like, you know, it's going to be fun to write this, but I also wanted to kind of give it like that modern taste, like where it's not modern, it's fantasy, but we have, you know, we have things that are going on in our lives now that you can see through the story.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, Salvagers, of course, being the sci-fi book that you've done, and successfully so, I believe. And, you know, it's interesting that you made a transition into fantasy. You know, you followed all this stuff up. It sounds like you made the decision to go fantasy before you did all this the research on it. What was it about fantasy after sci-fi that appealed to you?
Yeah, I feel like I've always been a fantasy fan, mm-hmm. and when writing Salvagers, I feel like a lot of my ideas were sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Every time I'd come up with an idea, like I would just, you know, place it in like some sci-fi world, and then I just, you know, I started coming up with this idea with these characters, mm-hmm. and it just felt right that it would be like kind of in this fantasy world, dark world. And so it kind of, you know, it just kind of started building that way. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, funny story is like, you know, when I had this whole story and I pitched it to Travis McIntyre at Source Point Press, mm-hmm. and, you know, he and I would text back and forth a lot, and I give him this idea, and I just see like those three little bubbles going where it's like, I know mm-hmm. he's typing, mm-hmm. and he writes, he's like, he, you know, he just writes, he's like, let's flip it. And then immediately mm-hmm. I'm like, ah, man, I'm like, I don't want to flip it. Like, I like my idea. Like, mm-hmm. I've been working on this. Mm-hmm. And then he, you know, he just hits me where, like, I had a, you know, I had, like, this main, you know, human character who was, you know, he was past his prime. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a hero, but he wasn't looked at as a hero anymore, and mm-hmm. he was locked up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this, he was locked up with these trolls. Mm-hmm. And so Travis was like, what if, you know, we make the ogre the hero? Mm-hmm. You know, and then he said, he was like, you know, and then instead of it locked up with the trolls, because I had a troll that I had two trolls that were alive and one was dead, and the one troll talked to this dead troll.
Oh, okay.
But there was no ghost. It was like these trolls were just crazy. Mm-hmm. And so he was like, and what if, you know, the ogre is chained to the dead guy, the, you know, the human, mm-hmm. and he's actually talking to his ghost. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of writers sometimes when something's changed like that, you know, there's a moment where you're just like, nah, that's stupid. Like, you know, I don't want, but, I, you know, I've always been, somebody who is very much willing to, accept change and listen to people who I trust and believe in. And but it was even a matter of that, like when Travis like brought me that, when he kind of flipped it like that, I just was like, I was like, no, like that's I like that. And so it really did. And then I just sat down and I wrote, you know, I wrote the outline for all three. I sent them over to him and he liked them, and then I just started scripting it, and it worked out. And the funny thing is flipping it like that, it made it perfect for Sean Daly's art. Hmm. The way I was, you know, my plan for it, I probably wouldn't have taken it to Sean. I probably would have looked for like, you know, a more like, you know,
realistic.
Well, yeah, like a Sean Murphy type mm-hmm. art. But when we flipped it, it was almost like this would be, you know, this would be kind of endearing. Like with Sean's art style, this would be an endearing book as well as, you know, a fun adventure.
I have to tell you a quick story. I was part of a group that was writing fan film scripts for Star Trek. And I had this story where I was trying to describe, there was a ship that we were writing stuff for that had no aliens on it. And I was trying to explain why there were no aliens on it. And I don't know how much Star Trek you're familiar with. There was this one time when there was this cloud creature that was that would drain all the corpuscles out of people. And I was so determined that had to be the main part of the story. And my friend, who was a more experienced scriptwriter, was telling me, oh, that's not going to work. It's just, you know, you can't do those kinds of things and stuff. And so we were eating dinner and we were talking about it. And afterwards, I'm driving him home. And I finally say, okay, let's just leave that go and then we'll go on. And we went a different direction. And the funniest thing about it was it turned out really well. But in the end, I still got to have that cloud creature in the story. That was when I finally let go of this notion that the cloud creature had to be the big thing. Then everything just fell into place after that. And so, you know, I've had experience that's similar to yours. You know, this, my friend was saying, no, that's, you can't do that. That's everybody is just, it's so standard stuff. And so once we let that go, by the time I had him to his house, we had beat out the whole story in a totally different direction. And so, you know, as writers, we kind of have to let other people's ideas through
You know, otherwise, it's, you know, I as much as I'm sure I would have enjoyed that story, I think this one is more creative on that sense. It's not that would have been bad.
But well, and the way I look at it is I think, like, and this is one of the things, you know, I love about Travis and working with him and trusting him with my ideas. Like, if I have an idea and I take it to him and, Travis will always, he'll say, hard pass. And then I don't even argue with him. I'm like, okay. Because I understand, like, you know, as writers and creators, we constantly have, like, these ideas. And in your mind, you think, like, this is great. And then when you present it to somebody, they look at it. You know, more realistically, and now that I do editing for Source Point Press, sometimes people will come to me and, you know, and they'll give me an idea, and the first thing I think is, I'm like, well, you know, you like, not everybody could sell that book. You know, that's a book that you like. It's a passion project for you, and only you could sell that book.
Right.
So you do kind of start thinking as an editor, you're like, I want you to do something where you can change that, where you can make everybody be able to sell it. Like, any Joe Schmo behind a table could be like, here's a book, here's the pitch, and people would be like, ah, that sounds great, I want to buy it. No, one of the things that I loved was Stephen King said, you know, write your first draft with the door closed. And then, you know, and then open your door up and let other people read it, and then open your door, write it with other people there.
It's so interesting to me. There's two things, points that I want to make about it, is that writers are vulnerable. You know, when you give your story out, you know, I help on an indie comic, and there's sometimes that, you know, I'm working with the writer, and he's so concerned that people are going to love the art and hate the story. And I'm going like, no. I said, look, the art's great, but your story's great too. So every time somebody comes up and tells them what a great story it is, I'm always going, see, it is a great story. And I know
who you're talking about too. And it is a good, it is a great story. Mm-hmm. But he and I have also talked. You know, we can say his name, but we've talked about it, and I do. I believe that a lot of writers do feel that way. You know, where we do feel like, you know, this. Most people are like, ah, this art's great, because in comic books, it's a very visual medium. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first thing somebody does is they flip through the comic book, and if the art looks good, then they're like, okay, you know what, I'll take a shot at it. Mm-hmm. But it's the writing, the writing that's going to retain the audience.
Exactly. It's the art that draws people, it's the writing that keeps them. Is the way I like to put. Now, let me tell you one other quick story, because as an editor, I always like to point out to people, because one of the things about indie comics that drives me nuts is the misuse of commas. But I have a little phrase. Every time I use it, people, oh, okay, now I get it. There's a phrase, you say, let's eat, comma, grandpa, is different from let's eat grandpa. And I always point that out to people. I say, see, there's a big difference between those sentences, and a comma is the only difference. Between it. Oh, okay, because sometimes I'm reading an indie book and I can't figure what they're trying to communicate in the dialogue, because there's no commas, there's no indications to what's going on. And I know you do a good job with that, because you're good with this good stuff. And I'm always trying to tell people, be conscious of, you know, let somebody else read your dialogue, but not just you. And see if they can understand, you know, what you're communicating. So, but anyway, I'm glad you're getting to edit, because we need more good editors, to be frank, in the indie world. So that'd be good. Let's get to the other characters. I mean, the ogre is my favorite character. There's no question about it. I like the ogre a lot. But there's other humans involved. Do you want to talk a little bit about the other humans that the ogre's interacting with?
I showed it to a friend of mine, and he's like, you know, I don't know any of their names. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote it, that was like intentional. It was intentional not to name any of them, except one. There's one character that we named. Mm-hmm. And because it was the way I looked at it was like, it's more the situation that's important, not the individual. Mm-hmm. But each person like has their own personality, and you know, you have the person who's kind of like, you know, that stubborn person who's mm-hmm. like, you're not going to convince me of this. Mm-hmm. And then you have like that, you know, the jack of all trades, the guy that's just kind of, he's there and, you know, he wants the same thing that everybody else does, mm-hmm. but he's more susceptible to being like, okay, I'll do what you need me to do. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have your, you have your other character who is the one that, I don't want to say too much, but mm-hmm. it's the one that, you know, kind of brings that, makes the person who doesn't want to change, the person that doesn't want to, you know, admit that, you know, maybe the way that they look at the world is wrong, that one person that just cares a little bit,
mm-hmm.
you know, and shows a little heart, mm-hmm. and you know, and that makes you kind of be like, you know what, okay, like I'm gonna give this a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
See, that's a fascinating point that you don't necessarily have names for them, because you know that's always a big deal in comics and fantasy and sci-fi for that matter. You got to come up with the names. You got to name everybody because that's a big deal. What if marketing gets a hold of them and they're going to make action figures or something? You got to have names for these people. You know, Star Wars, well, famous for that.
Well, and the funny thing is that they all do have names, mm-hmm. because when I was writing the script, I had to name him when I was talking to Sean Daly, the artist. Mm-hmm. He was like, you know, I need names for these people. Cause I had, you know, I had kind of a description,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I had, you know, I had the, you know, the one-eyed guy, the mustached guy. And he was like, I need names for these people. And so I was like, okay. I was like, but you know, the names don't matter. And he's like, it just helps me with my art, like mm-hmm. knowing their names and all that. So I was like, I got it. So they all actually do have names.
Mm-hmm.
All the trolls have names. Mm-hmm. Like, so I thought it was kind of like funny, like where George Lucas mm-hmm. named all of his characters.
Yes.
Like, even like the little character, like the characters that were like just on screen for like one moment,
right.
like three Yees.
Mm-hmm.
I always loved three Yees, three eyes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he was only on camera for like one, you know, 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. But George Lucas named all of them.
Well, because he's going to get action figures. He's going to be able to sell those and make some money off of those. Is what's going to happen.
Yeah. So if we have to make action figures, they do have names.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. But you know, to be honest with you, I didn't notice for the longest time that there was no names for them.
And that means a lot to me because I feel like it was one of the things in the writing that it was not a challenge, but kind of like, you know, you were afraid, like where it's like, okay, is this going to work? Or are people going to be like, well, you know, I don't really know who anybody is.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't know who this guy is. And I feel like when I, you know, and I've read it a million times in script, and I feel like I've read it a million times after Sean, drew it. And for me, I felt confident where I'm like, it doesn't, you know, these people don't need names. So I'm glad that you said it, because I needed somebody to, at least affirm to me that it didn't.
You know, I've already gone through issue two, and I came across the name, and I suddenly went, oh, there's a name. I haven't seen a name before, you know, and so that it struck me as something unusual when I saw it. But you know what? You've developed the characters strongly enough that we don't necessarily need to have names for these people. We know who they are. You know, somebody might one of them has red hair, for example. You might refer to the red-haired one, or the ghost, or the ogre. And what that does, that gives you a chance to play with the characters a lot more, I think. You know, there's certain things, like I said, there's certain revelations and stuff as things go along that really surprise me. And I like that because what you've done is you've set these characters realistically. Even the ogre is a realistic character, which to me still, I still find amazing. You know, as I wrote in my review, the ogre is the outsider looking in at humanity, which I really like. But all the characters have their place in the story, and it's not, you know, I don't think that they're stereotypical either. You're doing good things with them and making them their own character, which I like. And
thank you.
Because I, you know, so many times, one of the things I don't like about fantasy is that there are, you know, I don't want to use the word stereotypes, but there are kinds of characters that when they appear, they're going to be very similar to other characters like that. But with your book, the ogre, even the trolls are very different to me. I like the way that they interact with each other and with other people. And I like the fact that you did have more than just the ogre involved in the story, that you had other creature type people, you know, involved. And even as another creature, they still have, that's kind of reveals a bias to say they're human-like in the way that they do it. They act like trolls. Probably would act, but they speak English, which is you know, for, we have to have that for the story to proceed. But I like the way that they did things. Yeah. I like the way that everybody spoke to each other. It was very realistic. You know, I always said with Salvagers that could be on sci-fi, and I think with this book, this could also be a very very easily turned into like a sci-fi show, especially with CGI being what it is right now with the ogre. Unless you got a great big guy that wore a headmask or something like that, but you could do this show very easily.
Well, thank you. No, I appreciate that, and it's funny because the trolls are my favorite characters, and it was so, and when I was writing, like when I was writing this, my daughter got really like, she got big into The Lion King.
Okay.
And while I, when I was writing it, like I just, I, you know, the three hyenas that are, you know, are, you know, like are Scar's like henchmen, like they played kind of like a big part. Like when I was like looking at them, I was like, that's, I was like, that's kind of how I want my trolls to be. I want them to be, you know, like where you got that one leader and then you got that one idiot and then you got that one, like, you know, that, you know, the not leader or not idiot. And so that was like, that was it. And when I was kind of thinking, I was like that, I was like the, these hyenas, if my, like, if I had trolls that were like these hyenas in Lion King, and not obviously not exactly like them, but that archetype for the for that character. So then writing them, it just, I feel like I always build, like my villains are my favorites. And I always love building on the villains, just because it's like any story, you know. I remember George Acevedo, he sent me this this podcast. It was a DC Comics podcast, and it was all about building your villains. And one of the best things that said, and it was so true, is that your hero does nothing without the villain. You know, if the villain's not there, then the hero has nothing to spring to action to. The hero, you know, Clark Kent just goes and does his, you know, business at the Daily Planet, unless, you know, Lex Luthor does something. So your villain is the most interesting character, because he's the one, you know, that or he or she, your villain's the one that springs this story into action. You know, so, and this, like, I don't always want to do things like, so like where it's like, okay, like, you know, if you look at it as in terms of like how, you know, the North, the people that are winning this war, you would think that these trolls, you know, these trolls are the heroes. These trolls are the ones who are, you know, doing good and going out there and finding these fugitives and bringing them to justice. But if you can write it in such a way that you can make these heroes, you know, and you could turn them into bad guys. And it's, and it all comes back to, you know, the way the world is right now and how, you know, we're so divided. And, you know, some people believe that one way is absolutely right, where there's a whole nother group of people that look at that and they're like, how can you see it that way? That is so wrong, and vice versa. So that definitely kind of played a part in the writing of it.
Oh, it's cool. It's just very well done. Once again, I mean, you know, Salvagers was such a hit with me. I really loved the book, the blue-collar sci-fi stuff. I just think it's such a great book. And, you know, you always worry, is lightning going to strike twice? And yes, it does. This time, in Ogre, it's a very compelling story that is almost entirely different from Salvagers. So, you know, I'm glad when a writer can do more than one genre, because that means to me they're a really good writer. They can stretch those writing muscles in different ways. And I think you've done that really well with Ogre. I think that number one is just terrific.
Well, I appreciate it, Wayne. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, and I think, like, for anybody who's out there doing any kind of writing, I mean, and I'm sure that you don't need me to tell you this, it's, anything, like, you know, you always want to do better than the last thing you wrote. You know, when you look at the last thing you wrote, and if you're writing something at the time, you want to say, like, it needs to be better than that. You know, I think that a lot of great artists, creators out there, and writers out there, and even artists, I did a podcast with Sean Daly, and I could hear him, like, when he was talking, and it was like, he did a book called Samurai Grandpa, and you know, he was like, I wanted to, you know, with this book, I wanted to push myself even further and put, you know, and, you know, do even better. And so working with, you know, an artist that has that same mentality. And meanwhile, mind you, like, I have to say it, not only is Sean Daly an amazing artist, Sean Daly is an amazing writer. So it was, you know, and he was, you know, he even said, he was like, he kind of like didn't want to like overstep his bounds, but there were times, like, you know, he would give me a little advice. Like, he would say, like, I was thinking maybe we should do this. And I was very receptive to it, because, you know, I knew him. I was like, I know that he's just, you know, like, kind of like throwing it out there. Like, he's adding value to it. So working with him on this, like, really, it made me a better writer in the long run, because it made me look at things a lot different. So it's always, you know, you always want to try to do better than your last thing.
Yeah. So I'm always fascinated because there are certain writers in the entertainment industry who think that they're God, you know, gold drips from their pens, you know, when they write stuff, and it can never be changed. And, you know, there was a certain person I'm thinking of who would write the script and it would go down to where they were filming and they would use that script without any change to it. And there, and then if somebody wanted to make a change, he would say, I'm the writer, you're the TV show. You go make the show. I've got the script. I did the script.
I'm the exact opposite of that. I have imposter syndrome. So I'm like, you know, I have to work. I have to work doubly hard to make sure that, you know, it is good.
Well, I have to tell you, you write well. And it's great that you can take criticism. Not everybody can. I know so many people who cannot. But it's so great that you're able to do these things and make them work and tell a story. And not necessarily the same story either, over and over. Because, you know, there are certain writers that when I start to read their work, every once in a while I go, oh, yeah, I read this story before.
That's a good thing with having, like, a good editor. You know, there was a story that I started kind of pitching to Source Point Press. And, well, Travis, after I already finished writing Ogre. And it was... in my mind, I was like, this is totally different. And he had to point out, he was like, you realize, like, this is Ogre. Like, this is exactly Ogre. what's funny is that I talk a lot of writers. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that writers go through that they tend to, it's almost like subconsciously. You write something, and then the next thing you write, you don't even realize it until you really look at it. In a broad scale, you're like, oh, this is the same thing. Like, you know, it's not the same thing, but you're like, when you look at it, you know, in like, you know, bare bones, you're like, it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
And that made sense. And I was glad that, you know, he gave me that criticism, because then I was like, okay, I'd start pitching something else. And then I'd look and I'd be like, nope, that's too close to it. Till now I'm working on an outline for a Diesel Punk story. Hmm. And it's, you know, it's totally different.
Mm-hmm. So that's good.
See,
the thing of it is, though, is you've used those muscles that one and successfully so. And so it's easy to go back down that same road. There's so many people who do that. And I am always stunned, you know, when I can read something I haven't read before. And that Ogre to me is that I can't wait for people to get to see it. Speaking of which, when is Ogre coming out? It's in this month's order form, right?
Yes. So right now it is in August's previews catalog, and I think that I'm always curious of how it works, because I know it says that you have to have your orders in by August 18th, but I believe you can keep putting your orders in before that or after that.
Yeah, it's a little flexible.
Yeah. So then Ogre 2 will be in September catalog.
Cool.
And meanwhile, Ogre 1 will hit stores on Halloween, mm-hmm. October 31st, which is a Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited about that, because mm-hmm. it's going to be hitting stores with Holliston, the second volume of Holliston, Carnival Carnage. And that's an Adam Green, Adam Green horror TV show mm-hmm. that Source Point Press got the rights to and turned it into a comic book, drawn by Stephen Schrar, written by Greg Wright, Josh Warner, and has a lot to do with that as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a big book. It's a great book. Adam Green is a huge supporter of it. And if you don't know who Adam Green is, check him out. He's a huge entity in kind of the horror biz. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited about that. And then next month, September, Ogre number 2 will be out, mm-hmm. and that will hit stores in November. Mm-hmm. And then Ogre 3 will be out and available to pre-order in October, and will be in stores in December. So it's, mm-hmm. I'm going to have a lot of work to do.
Yeah,
basically what I'm doing is I'm pushing the previews, the pre-orders, mm-hmm. and then I'm telling, you know, then I'm like probably going to be in comic shops mm-hmm. from October, November, and December mm-hmm. doing signings. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Anybody who knows me, like I'm big on Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. I like to do the Kickstarter pre-sales, mm-hmm. and you know, this was the one, you know, this one thing like where we really wanted to, as Source Point Press and myself, like really wanted to kind of put a dent for our brand in Diamond. So, anybody that's going out there, every pre-order helps. The code, you go to a comic shop and you just tell them page 400 Ogre is a featured item, mm-hmm. and the code is AUG182199. Mm-hmm. Again, it's AUG182199. And walking into a comic shop and ordering a Source Point Press comic or a Bob Sally comic, like, that's probably the best thing that you can do, mm-hmm. because that, like, shows the shop owners, like, when that name keeps coming up, the Source Point Press name keeps coming up, or the Bob Sally name keeps coming up, that makes the shop owner start taking notice, and that makes them start thinking, like, well, you know what, maybe I should just start carrying their stuff without anybody even ordering it. Mm-hmm. And that's our goal. That's our goal. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's the end goal.
It's very good. Now, but I didn't want to let you go without talking about how great I thought the art was. It's a little craggy. It's not, as we mentioned a little bit before, that it's not necessarily superheroic style. It's much more the fan. It fits. You're right. It fits the fantasy thing so well. I like that and the choice of colors really good. I really like the facial expressions and action are both really well done. And I just think that the artwork, our team did a wonderful job on it. I think it's one of those things that will entice you to like other things besides superhero stuff. So it's great stuff.
Well, I'd like to add, when you say the art team, mm-hmm. there's only one person. Oh, Sean Daly did everything.
Oh, I didn't know
he did the
both.
Inks. He did everything. He even lettered it.
Wow.
So the man is amazing. He's from Toronto. Just the nicest guy you'll ever meet. And when you see this artwork, he's only been doing art, I think, for the past four or five years.
Wow.
And I mean, the guy is amazing. When you see the artwork, I'm sure that when Wayne posts this podcast, you'll tag some, you know, you'll add some of the artwork on there. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's watercolored. Mm-hmm. And he's a true genius to work with. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad. I'm sure that he's going to go on to do amazing things, mm-hmm. and it's going to be one of those things where, like, I'll just be able to say, like, I'm glad that I had a chance to work with him because he's amazing. Mm-hmm.
So how many issues are in the Ogre miniseries?
So this one's three issues, mm-hmm. and, you know, we kind of talked. We were like, well, you know, if it's popular, like, we'll do another one. Mm-hmm. And I think we're already kind of determined because Sean and I love it so much, mm-hmm. Travis loves it so much. Mm. We're like, you know what? Let's just do it. Like, mm-hmm. so we've already kind of got an idea what we want to do for, like, another, you know, a follow up. Mm. And it would be my idea of it would be all new characters and a whole new situation that's happening at the same time that this one is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, there'd be moments where you would kind of, if you read the first one. Mm-hmm. You would kind of be like, oh, wow, like, that's happening over there, which is the first one, and this is happening over here, which is the new one. So mm-hmm. we'll see. Sean and I are going to be we're both going to be at Fan Expo mm-hmm. in Toronto
right
at the end of the month. So he and I are going to sit down and with a notebook and just kind of, you know, come up with one, because I did say, like, I kind of wanted him to have a little more input on, you know, the storyline and the outline for it, because, like I said, I mean, he's a brilliant writer, so mm-hmm. I felt like he should have a little bit of an input. Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm sorry to answer your question. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a three issue trade, mm-hmm. and it's going to be issues 1, 2, and 3 are going to be sold separately, mm-hmm. and then we'll probably do something next year. We'll probably do something where we put it together in you know, kind of like an omnibus you know, thing, once, like, the next three are done. So it won't even be these three in a trade. It'll be the next three in a trade. It'll be like a big thing, and it might not even be next, you know, I never know what they want to do.
Oh, so the first three are individual issues, but the second one's a trade?
No, the second one will be individual issues too.
Okay.
But I think what we're thinking is, like, once all that's done, we might have, you know, we might do some kind of, you know, maybe 2019, 2020, you know, big hardback trade, you know, hardcover thing for it. But I don't know if I'm supposed to say that or not.
Well, it's still possible. It's not the definite. Yeah. But, and also, if I could recommend something, I would say around Halloween would be a wonderful time to put this out. I think that would go super duper then.
Absolutely. And the thing is, so it's coming out on Halloween Comic Fest, mm-hmm. and Source Point Press, we actually have a comic book that is participating in Halloween Comic Fest. So that's really exciting, because it's very rare that a small press gets to participate in mm-hmm. that.
Very good, very good. Well, this is great stuff. Now, why don't you give us a quick update on Salvagers, how that universe is doing?
Salvagers Universe is great. Right now, we are in the midst of the third volume, the Havoc of Blackbane. That is getting, I think there's like 6 pages left that need to be lettered, and that's going to print. I do the, you know, with Salvagers, I do the individual issues in Kickstarter, and that's how you can get the individual issues. So we're already 6 pages into issue 2 of Havoc of Blackbane, and I'll probably be running like a 15-day Kickstarter in October, just so people can, you know, jump on that and get the, you know, get the next issue of that. But I'm working with a new guy from France, Eric Goodall, and he's I love his artwork. It's, you know, I mean, I loved George's and I loved Chris's, but you know, unfortunately, when you work with artists and they're amazing artists, they get picked up to do other things, so you got to keep up on it. But it is, it's great. It's moving forward. I'm hoping to have volume 3 done by the end of this year, if not beginning of 2019. And we also have other creative writers and artists that are pairing together to do one shots, Salvager one shots. Which I'm excited for, because I feel like it's really building the Salvagers franchise. It's always been a dream of mine to build my own franchise, and I feel like I met David Hayes, and Stan Yak is an artist who I've always wanted to see him do a Salvagers book. So if you follow me on Facebook or Instagram, I keep posting pictures that Stan's sending. It's an amazing book. David Hayes is like he's an amazing horror writer. So he had, like, I gave him, you know, this opportunity to work with Stan Yak, and he wrote this amazing horror, you know, this horror sci-fi book. And it's basically that this crew has to go and salvage a ship where there's this, you know, this kind of alien plague, and it takes over these Graxans, which are Brigby's species. So it's almost like all these zombie Graxans, like all these zombie Brigbys that are going. And it's beautifully drawn. It's going to be awesome. But for me, the idea of it was is that Salvagers are being sold in trades, and they're $18. When you go to a convention, we usually will sell them for 20% off, still $15. And people that don't know it might be skeptical. They might be like, well, I don't want to spend $15 on something that I don't know. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to create, a $3.99 book that we could throw into different packages, and somebody could get, instead of buying the whole trade, they could get a little piece of it. And then if they liked it, they would know, like, oh, like there's 2 or 3 trades out there of the same universe. And hopefully that would kind of entice them to bring them in, you know, kind of spend a little bit to get to know it. And then if you like it, you know, that there's other books out there that you can get. So that book will probably be done, you know, I would say that book would be done by the end of the year, by this winter. And, you know, so it'll be available soon. And it looks great. And, you know, the team is amazing.
Well, you're one busy guy. You know, not only you're editing, but you're also working on Salvagers and Ogre, and both of which I really tremendously like and think that that's great stuff. And I got a feeling we're going to hear a lot more from you. I bet, knowing you, you probably got other irons in the fire that we'll hear about before too long.
Well, then, you know, that's the way it is. You know, you got to keep yourself busy.
Yeah, well, you're doing great, Bob. Everything's always tremendous. When people get to 1, I think they're going to love it, but then I think they're going to really love number 2, because I was stunned when I got to read that one. So Ogre is one of those books, I think, that it's one of those gems that you should be buying. If you're not, let your store know and be sure to get in there and tell them you don't only want number 1, you want them all. So be sure to do that. So that'll be good. So Bob, keep it up, man. Someday when you get to eat and sleep, we'll miss you on this thing. But right now you're a busy guy, and that's a good thing for us.
Thank you very much, Wayne. Thanks for having me on. I always got to say that the reason why I love being on this show, and the reason why I love listening to your podcast, is that you are the Bob Ross of comic podcast. You got that voice, and I don't want to say it's the voice that puts you to sleep. It's the most calming voice in all of podcasting, and I love it. Don't change a bit.
Some people say I sound like Casey Kasem, but I don't get that one.
Hey, no, I like that. Yeah, definitely. What? It's the older generation know who he is.
That's right. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I you know, and whenever I see you at a convention, it's always a pleasure seeing you and Rick and that whole team. I love seeing you guys. So I hope to see you I don't know if you'll be at Boston Fan Expo, New York Comic Con, Baltimore.
Our schedule is a little scattered this year. Rick will be at Fan Expo Canada. I didn't find out about it until too late. I had to get a new birth certificate. I don't think I'm going to be able to get a passport in time.
Yeah.
But I'd love to get there. But anyway, Bob, boy, keep it up. I know you're a busy guy, but that makes us happy when you're really keeping busy. So keep it up.
Well, thank you for having me on, Wayne.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Be sure to be back next week when we'll have more interviews and other good things. But until then, keep reading your comics.